Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your talk show host, Randy Fine. Does a root canal scare you less than public speaking? If so, you're not alone. While any number of books, websites, and other resources claim to offer help, few deliver. That's why today's special guest, Lisa Wentz, wrote Grace Under Pressure, a masterclass in public speaking. Lisa has spent the past decade dedicating her life to helping professional and amateur public speakers overcome blocks, develop their voices, and craft their delivery. Her background includes extensive study in psychology and 10 years of professional acting, training, and live performance. Lisa has helped even the most anxious speakers take to the stage with grace and poise. The founder of the San Francisco Voice Center, her background is unique even among the top public speaking experts. Wentz is the only professional in California and one of the few in the U.S. to hold both a degree in the Alexander Technique, the premier teaching model for all modern voice work, and a master's degree in voice and speech studies. So let's get started. I'm excited to introduce my guest to you. Good morning, Lisa, and welcome to A Fine Time for Healing.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So you wrote the book Grace Under Pressure to help people with public speaking. Is this book applicable to I guess it's applicable to acting, but really it's something we can use in our life in all ways, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The reason that the subtitle is a masterclass in public speaking is because that there's, I think, 34 exercises throughout the book. And the book has three sections to it. You might not find every single aspect of the book applicable to you personally, but in your training. But throughout the book, you definitely receive a journey and a class.
Right. You do have a lot of exercises. I've been through the book. You know, I wanted to talk about, previous trauma and how it affects speaking, because so many of my listeners are survivors of emotional trauma, sometimes physical, sometimes sexual. And I know that you talk about that. I was really surprised to see that you talk about trauma and the inner critic. So can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. So the reason that I put the first part of the book, it's split into three sections, and the first part deals more directly with what you're referring to, and I titled that section, What Holds Us Back. And what I mean by that is what holds us back from feeling like we are capable of speaking up in meetings, what holds us back from taking speaking engagements that are more public, what holds us back from presenting ourselves in an authoritative way. It could show up in many different aspects of your life in terms of communication skills. As far as trauma is concerned, what I noticed after years of private practice is that some of my clients were coming in with the same sorts of stories and same issues over the years, and or similar. And there was one client in particular that I refer to in the book. I've changed all the names, of course, and occupations that respect anonymity. There was one client in particular that really was the catalyst for writing this section. She was very, very tortured by what we consider the inner critic, a negative, nagging voice that constantly told her she wasn't good enough. And this was a doctor who was very well respected in her field, obviously very intelligent, and a very kind, kind person. And she had an abusive mother her whole life, emotionally abusive and mentally cruel for many years, even into her teens. And she was so held back by that inner voice that she was still carrying around with her. Part of me just felt so strongly that I really don't want people to feel as isolated as I see some of my clients feel, and I have experienced in my own life, when it comes to these setbacks. Oftentimes when we are receiving a certain type of abuse or negative messaging, we can think that we are alone in it, that this is somehow special towards us, and that others aren't experiencing the same thing or similar things. And I think that part of healing that piece is to know that we're not alone. Many people have gone through what we've gone through, and that there is a path to healing and empowerment. And part of that path is sharing. And it's maybe why people go into group therapy. It's maybe why people go into certain environments, community environments, their church socials. Could be many different ways. There's never just one way. But you do need to share it. In its secrecy, it has power over you, those negative voices. The more you get them out and talk to a friend about it, a therapist about it, a group of people about it, the less it will have control over you. And so I wanted very much to at least make that point in the beginning of the book, and then also connect dots for other types of negative messaging, meaning that, you know, it's not always a caregiver. You might receive some very bad feedback from or negative messaging or abuse from. It could be a school teacher. It could be a counselor. It could be bullying. It could be early work environments, a boss. And it's easy when we're young to absorb these kinds of negative experiences, internalize them, and keep them with us. Does that all make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Everything that happens when we're young, we internalize and keep with us, good and bad. So until we become cognizant of it, we carry it around, and it affects everything we do. And you talk about it because it really can stand in the way, I guess, of someone's self-esteem in terms of getting up in front of people, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think that when we stand up to speak, let's say we're starting to put ourselves out there in the workplace, or we're getting to speak at meetings more, or or asked to speak at some kind of a event, it really feels vulnerable. I mean, it makes it feel vulnerable because it's not something we're used to, because suddenly all these eyes are on us, which is not something we're used to. And when we're feeling more vulnerable, when we're feeling more watched, it can increase anxiety, which is also called stage fright for some people. And then we don't know what to do with that anxiety. You know, it's not as though most of us, and I really mean most of us, we don't have that kind of training when we're growing up. We don't have a public speaking course in school. We don't have, you know, debate courses that really deal with anything beyond just structuring an argument. You know, we don't really, we're not trained. And then that also increases our anxiety, I think, because most of what we do when we're putting something into practice, we are being trained to do it. If you enter a job, you'll be trained to some degree, or you went to school for that particular skill, you know. But if we don't go to school for the skill of public speaking, then, of course, we'll stand up and suddenly we feel like we don't know what to do and all these eyes are on us, and we have often an unrealistic sort of an unrealistic expectation for perfection coupled with a fear of judgment. And that's, you know, basically what stage fright is.
So what are some of the common things that people who have no experience get up and do? Do they do something with their hands? Do they do something with their posture? What are some of the things that people may do and not realize they're doing?
First thing is they don't breathe as much as they need to be breathing. Of course, they're still breathing or else they would pass out. You know, and we have to get oxygen to the brain. That's just the truth, right? We've all probably been in that experience to some degree. It's a mild fight or flight for some people. For some people, it's a very severe fight or flight response. So you tighten your neck, your chest starts to tighten, and you notice that you're not breathing as much if you're tuned into it. Others will just not breathe as much, and they don't realize it. And that will increase their adrenaline rush and increase their or decrease their ability to focus on what they're saying and their messaging and why they're there and all of that. So if you're having a physiological response, that's the first way it shows up. Lack of breathing, you're not breathing as deeply anymore, you're taking little catch breaths, your chest will feel tightened. Other things, it may or may not, you may be very good at hiding these kind of physiological responses. Some people are. And others, it might show up with a shaky voice, maybe shaky hands, maybe sweating. For myself, if I'm really, really nervous, it doesn't happen that often anymore. But let's say at some point in my life I was, I would get a little redness on my chest or something like that. So those are some of the more common things, I think, that happen in terms of how does nervousness physically manifest.
So when I watch speakers, like on, you know, TED Talks and things like that, I see that they use their hands in, either they have them folded or they're sort of pointing them out to make a point or something like that. Do all speakers need to use their hands in some particular way to, excuse me, to emphasize what they're saying?
Not necessarily. It depends on the context. If you are behind a podium, you don't really need to. Your hands can be on the podium. You can move your hands if you want to. I think most people want to because you have a certain amount of energy. You are trying to get a point across, and that energy has to go somewhere. It typically would go into your voice, but you might also want to gesture, and that's fine. As far as a TED Talk is concerned, because that's very much a full frontal, you're not behind anything, and you want to be facing the audience, yes, I do agree. Many people will make points with their hands, whether they're smaller or bigger, you know, depends on the person. Whether you have to or not, I think stillness is a very good thing and a very powerful thing and reads as very high status and authority. But a full 20-minute talk, you're going to want to move. It's not natural to be completely still. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, of course. So you have a degree in the Alexander Breath Technique. What exactly is that?
So Alexander Technique, it's not necessarily a breath technique, although there are some aspects to breathing. F.M. Alexander was a Shakespearean actor in the late 1800s, and back in the days when there weren't voice coaches, and he was losing his voice repeatedly. There wasn't really a doctor that could help him. They weren't sure what was going on with him. And of course, if he's losing his voice as an actor, you can't work. So he took it upon himself to figure it out. And what he noticed was that he had a habitual response every time he went up on stage to speak. And that response was to contract or tighten the top of his neck, pull his head back, and tighten his larynx. So it was straining his vocal folds to the point where, of course, he was losing his voice. What he did then was he observed himself in many different environments for 3 months until he realized that he could undo this habit. So he created a system of undoing automatic responses or habits to given stimuluses. And that system now is taught with hands-on, you know, a teacher touching you. But it's not a massage or a therapy in that sense. It's really more of a guide. And a teacher would guide you to increase your own awareness, your own kinesthetic sense, and sort of put together in place his system, which starts with inhibiting an automatic response to a stimulus, redirecting yourself with your head-neck-back relationship at the start of your primary control of coordination, and then making different choices that way. And it goes, you know, like any really good technique, it's going to go beyond just postural awareness and physical use. One of the things he often said, and he wrote 4 books about his experiences and the technique, is that we are mental physical creatures, and separating ourselves into physical beings and or mental beings or physical activity and or mental activity doesn't do us any favors. That we need to be connected mentally to everything that we're doing, or at least aware of what we're doing. And anyway, I could go on and on and on about it. It's an interesting,
you know, it's interesting.
Kinesthetic. Yeah, it's a highly kinesthetic experience. So it's a little tricky to describe it to where somebody would really get it over, you know, over the radio or whatnot. But definitely worth looking into. And so in any case, yes, he developed in the late 1800s, wrote his books in the early 1900s, and developed training courses, and now there's training courses in many countries around the world. And you'll more likely than not find Alexander Technique teachers in the program within drama conservatories where actors are training to get their BFAs or their MFAs, and music conservatories, and places where people really have to use themselves efficiently and with less and less tension.
That's really cool. I never knew about that. I mean, I guess if you're not in that arena, you don't, you know, it's just something you don't know. But that's really cool. You say there's 3 kinds of resonance that we can use with our vocal sounds. What are the 3, and can you elaborate on them, please?
Thank you for asking. Yeah, that might be. So I did write that in the book, and the 3rd one might be slightly cheeky, but what I meant by 3 types of resonance are there's a primary resonance, which is the sound waves leaving your vocal folds, going through your vocal tract, and then coming out to be heard, which is what you're hearing right now. You're hearing my primary resonance. There's secondary resonance that we experience, which is the sound waves traveling through the vocal folds are absorbed and travel through your bones. It's also called bones. It's also called bone convection. And why it's important to notice that or to point it out is that many people will say things like, when I hear myself recorded, I don't sound like I think I sound. Or when I hear myself recorded, my pitch is way higher than I thought it was. I don't like the sound of my voice. Those kinds of things, right? The reason is because when we're speaking, we hear both primary and secondary resonance. So to us, our voice does sound deeper. But the resonance that you're hearing from me is a slightly higher pitch, slightly different than the resonance I'm hearing, because I'm also hearing the inner sound waves. Then the 3rd type of resonance, what I meant by that is a resonance sort of between me and the audience. So it's something sort of resonating with you. That's what I meant by that 3rd type of resonance. And I think I quote, I don't have the quote in front of me right now, but I quote Lindsay Buckingham talking about Fleetwood Mac and how there seemed to be another resonant experience between that was going on within the band and to the audience that none of us really could control. It was just there. And maybe any musician would say it. By the way, I'm not putting that verbatim again, I want to say. But I thought that was a really interesting, profound statement.
It is. Yeah, I mean, because I know I sound totally different when I listen to my shows. Let's talk about articulation a little bit.
Sure.
So depending on where we come from in the country, we articulate differently. And I come from Baltimore, where T's are pronounced as D's. Everything's really pronounced wrong there. So I live in Florida now, and I've been here for several years. So I've had to undo some of them. There's still some, you know, some left. But, you know, I've had to really work on saying my T's in words. What are some of the common things that people do not articulate well?
Well, you know, and like you pointed out, there's accents all over the United States, native English accents all over the United States. And so the question of articulating something well, there's two ways to look at it. One, we have to respect that accents exist, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's the first thing. So the way that you articulate your T's and D's may be slightly different than somebody else in a different part of the country. Where I put my interest is in whether or not the majority of people listening to you can understand you. That's what's important for me. And then so that's the baseline. And the second part is articulating well. So really being clear with your speech so that people can understand you, they can hear you, they're absorbing the information without much strain at all. I think the question you're asking me, to get back to it, what are the things that people don't articulate well? So if we're talking about just Americans, I think that there's a lack.
Well, we could start with that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's just say you were in a drama conservatory or a public speaking class that was teaching articulation. Typically what they would teach you is to increase the movement of your lips and your tongue tip. Americans are very good at moving their jaw for the most part. We access our jaw movement really well, but our lips and our tongue tip are not always as precise as they should be. And certainly I'm completely as guilty of that as well. If I'm tired, I'm not nearly as articulate as I am, say, in the middle of the day when I'm teaching and whatnot. So anything that would be a lip consonant or a tongue tip consonant could be sharpened. You can always sharpen your articulation. And by the way, and I think I say this in the book as well, it's one of the easiest things you can do and the most effective and the quickest turnaround. So let's say you've got a last-minute phone interview, or you've got a last-minute podcast, or you've got a last-minute something, and I'm speaking to your listeners and to you as well. If you want to do something that's going to give you really good results in just a few minutes, one, definitely deepen your breath right away so that you're focused and you're fueling your voice. But the second one is you can do articulation exercises to pick up your articulation and be heard really well.
Hmm.
That's the one area that will give you the fastest results.
Okay. And we can find those articulation exercises in here, right? In the book. Grace Under Pressure. Okay. All right. That's good to know.
Sure.
Another thing you talk about is pacing. You know, it's I remember back when I was 13 years old and I was getting ready for my bat mitzvah. And I remember being told to pace myself and take my time, because some kids just get up there and they say it so fast and, you know, and they just run through it and it's not good. So I really kind of remember that way back. We tend to talk faster when we're nervous, right?
Yeah. Sure. So as we were talking about before, the heart rate speeds up a little bit. You've got an adrenaline rush going. And then, many people, when they're nervous, will speak faster. And it's interesting to me for a few reasons. One, it could be also stemming from not just the physical side that we're discussing now, which is that we're getting faster and we won't even realize that we're getting faster. We're just following our own tempo and rhythm. And the other part is that sometimes people just really want to get off the stage. They want it to be over with, either consciously or subconsciously, and don't realize that they're rushing to it to get it over with, a particular speech or talk or whatever. But one of the great things that you can do that'll give you some feedback is just simply record yourself. I think there's a lot of people who don't really think of that. And when they do finally record themselves, they can hear it back or see and hear it back and realize, oh, wow, that is way faster than I should be speaking, and I'm not pausing and those kinds of things.
That's a
so
good
getting
idea.
That kind of feedback is good. It's important. And
right.
Relating back to the inner critic or any kind of critiquing, whenever you record yourself or see yourself on a video somebody else recorded or whatever, best to think in terms of critiquing, never think in terms of criticizing. So meaning that if you're going to be listening to yourself, think about it in terms of a healthy, productive, what can I learn from this sort of way mindset. You know, maybe, oh, I was sped up that middle section because I'm not that connected to that middle section. Next time I need to slow it down. Or maybe I spoke too long in the beginning, the welcoming. I don't need that long of a welcoming. I'm going to shorten it next time. Those kinds of critiquings are very healthy, and they give you somewhere to go. When you just criticize yourself and say, oh, that was terrible. I spoke too fast. I'm no good at this. You have nowhere to go with that. So it's important to remember your mindset is everything. You have to be coming from a creative place that is right for you in terms of your critiquing, but never criticize when you're listening.
And I think that goes for everything we do. You know, we really, you know, I tell people that I work with who are narcissistically abused, you know, all of them have low self-esteem initially. And one of the things that contributes to it is the negative self-talk. So it's really hard to get out of that hole of self-esteem when you're always talking to yourself in a negative way. So I really like that. Critiquing, not criticizing. I like that. I'm going to use that. So, you know, I've heard some people say when you get up there, you want to start by telling a story or loosening up your audience. Do you have any recommendations for how to start that?
Sure. Going back to, you know, what's appropriate for the setting, you always have to consider that. Because there are some audiences and some situations, of course, you could be telling a fun story or, you know, a wedding. If you have to speak at a wedding, and that's an interesting one. People will often be thrown off by the personal events, even if they're very used to speaking in a professional way, you know. So things like when you're telling a personal story or some kind of a warm-up story in a personal setting, like a wedding or something like that, can be very useful. If you are talking to your team members, your staff at a quarterly meeting or a yearly meeting or a retreat or something like that, some stories can be great, or a story can be great to start whatever your talk is going to be about. And to have a reason for telling the story that, of course, makes sense for the rest of your speech, ties into the rest of your speech, and with an intention typically of bringing people together, getting people to focus in the room, putting people at ease, welcoming people in a warm way, in an endearing way. Stories can do all of those things. Now, in other settings, they may be a little less appropriate. It depends. It depends on what it is that you are doing.
Right.
And
if it's very academic,
advice,
you know, right. If it's very academic,
yeah, exactly.
Or something like that, then yeah. I can see where you would say that.
A personal story. Yeah. And then
right.
Also another one is for founders. You know, founders have to do pitches. They have to give pitches to investors and several of them. And how much of a personal story do you tell in a pitch is always a question that I get from founders that are developing their pitches. And when founding a company, you do want to give some insight into why you decided to create the company, and that usually has an element of a personal journey in it, but it doesn't have to be particularly long. It's just letting the audience get to know you a little bit. So that's another specific type of storytelling for a specific purpose in a specific setting that can be very useful.
Thank you for that. That all makes sense. In your book, you talk about a woman who lost her job or didn't get a job because of eye rolling, and she didn't even realize she was doing it. What are some of the things that we do that other people see and we don't even realize we're doing? Besides eye rolling.
That's a great question. That's a great question. You know, in terms of public speaking, because that was more, you know, just at work, she was doing that. In terms of public speaking, I think oftentimes it's a postural habit that people don't realize they're doing. So it could be slouching. It could be pacing. That, you know, when somebody has a lot of energy, they just start pacing and they don't even realize they're pacing a bit. The slouching is very common. I think of something more postural related. Yeah. I think those are the two big ones. Sort of chaotic energy where you're moving and you don't even realize you're moving. You know. And in those situations, if I have a client doing that, then I'll just film it for them, give them the feedback and show them. Sometimes I'll decide not, depends on how severe it is. If I decide not to film it, then I'll just get up and I'll imitate them and repeat what they said and how they moved while they said it, and so that they can see it's not really supporting their messaging, but rather distracting from it.
Yeah, I could see where posture would be a problem, and definitely pacing. But, you know, yeah, if you're not behind a podium, you do want to kind of walk back and forth a little bit. But, you know, I guess pacing would be very annoying for the audience to watch.
Right. You know, a few minutes ago, I mentioned, you know, you have energy. We have energy because our adrenaline rush is going to increase when we're in front of an audience, even if we're used to it. You know, there's degrees. It might just increase a little bit, give a little extra energy, and we might even like that. Or for some, it's too much energy, and we don't know how to deal with it. But if you can take that energy, put it into your voice, put it into your messaging, and also put it into movement that supports your messaging, whether it's a hand gesture that's like you mentioned a minute ago, or whether it's finishing one section of your speech and now you're turning to another section, then that's where you want to move. You can support your messaging with movement so that you're leading the audience as opposed to distracting with movement. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. Oh, I can. Yeah, I mean, you don't want somebody up there. It's like, you know, when you say that, I think of Bernie Sanders, who ran for the last election. His hands are wild. They fly around when he talks.
Yeah, he points a lot.
And he just, his hands are always moving, and it is so bothersome to me. I can't even watch him, because all I'm looking at are the hands.
I find that. Yeah, I find it a little bit endearing because he does it so consistently, and people, a lot of comedians and whatnot, make fun of him for it, but in a very, or fun of that aspect of his speaking style, but in a sort of endearing way, you know? So for me, it doesn't really bother me that much because it's become such a thing for him, an identifiable trait that he has.
Yeah, it is.
When it comes to politicians, I hear you. You have to be a really good speaker. And Sanders is somebody who really knows how to use rhetoric. I don't necessarily mean that in a negative way. Rhetoric is, by definition, language that influences people. And you have to be a great speaker to really climb that high on the ladder, of course, to be influencing as many people as he does. So to me, it doesn't bother me so much. However, you know, what people say, that is more important to me for sure than their little tics. But it's
right.
Interesting, if I can talk about political speakers for a second,
sure.
Because we're seeing so much of them right now, given the Democratic debates and whatnot. It's interesting how much body language can make or break your speech or your performance. And I watched both the Democratic primary debates, of course, because this is what I do. I coach public speakers. I have to watch these big things. And, you know, a lot of pundits felt that O'Rourke really didn't perform well. And not criticized in a mean way, but really just like, okay, he's done. That's it. That was his one chance. He's blown it. He's done. And what's interesting about that is if you look at the transcript, nothing that was said was particularly off. In fact, it was very clear, very clearly articulated policies. However, he is one of those people who has a lot of energy. The energy comes up and it starts to look chaotic. And he doesn't know. And if you're giving a rally if you're in an environment where you're pumping up a crowd, that kind of energy is fabulous. But if you're in a film situation, if you're in a debate, or let's say you're talking to, you know, someone in the media, if one of your listeners has to be on television or has to be, you know, sitting down or something like that, then if you have that much energy and you don't know what to do with it, it just comes across as a little bit chaotic, or it can read as really young and not as powerful. And one of the specific things that I noticed with him, that he does put a lot of his energy into movement. Like I said, on camera, that doesn't work as well. And the second part, I noticed that he often turns to look. So he turns slightly away from the audience to look at the person who's attacking him. And by doing that, he lets the audience follow their eyes to the person as opposed to stay on him. And that kind of body language does not work for debate. It does not work for increasing your status and your authority. You're giving your authority away, basically. I don't want to talk too much, go any further deeply into that, but what can we learn from that? We can learn a few things. One, if you're standing up on stage and you're presenting, it also speaks to a point I often say to clients. You don't ever turn your back on an audience. And if you have to gesture upstage or to your slides or something like that, you can still keep your body very fully front and center to the stage. You just slightly move your eyes and your hands. That would be another appropriate place for body language to support your messaging. But you never really want to turn your back or turn sideways from the audience. You want the eyes on you.
Okay.
Does it make sense?
Yeah, good tip. Good tip. You know, I was surprised to read in your book that, you know, some of the people who really are great speakers now and weren't initially, but you were talking about, I think you were talking about Bill Clinton, how he has been practicing this for so many years, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was he's a very, very smart person, and regardless of what you think of his politics, anybody, because it's important to see what can we learn from different people, whether we would necessarily agree with them or not. And it's very clear, two things are very clear watching him, even when he was younger. One, that he really likes speaking in public. He very much enjoys the experience of being in front of an audience, and it shows, and it adds to his charisma. When we're watching a speaker who really enjoys themselves, and by the way, enjoys themselves in terms of their connection to the audience, that's important, because when we watch a narcissist can come across as enjoying themselves, but it's all about them. It's greedy. They're taking all the energy in the room, they're soaking it up, and they really don't care about their audience, let's be honest. But with somebody who does care about their audience and they're enjoying the process of it, it makes it more enjoyable for the audience to watch them, of course. So that's one thing that I noticed about him as a speaker, being a really great speaker. The other part is the practice. If you want to be good at something, yes, you absolutely have to practice. And he honed his skills for many years before he really had to be on television debating. You know, unlike some of the candidates we're seeing right now in the presidential primary who haven't fully honed their skills yet, but they're standing up, you know, being
right
on a televised debate. It's really quite a lot of pressure, isn't it?
It is.
But I'm sorry, did I lose my train of thought there?
You answered my question.
Yeah. But he went as far as to constantly hold debates in his house, which a lot of people wouldn't do. You know, a lot of people will just separate. And I'm not saying one is healthier than the other. That's your personal choice. Because maybe you want to go home to your family and not deal with anything that's work-related. But for him, he had Chelsea and Hillary constantly debating him. And according to the stories, you would have even a friend or two come in to practice debating in the living room. So he was really practicing.
That's funny. That's an interesting little piece of trivia there. I just want to ask you really quick, if you could come up with, you know, the best speaker that you know, who would that be? That we all know, that we can relate to.
Oh, that we all know. Gosh, you know, that's a really great question, because it's pretty subjective, isn't it? somebody might like one person's style more than another person. So who can we relate to is also based on, you know, identity. Who do I identify with? Who speaks to me? Who has some similar something in me that I feel is familiar? I think that that's what we respond to. As far as who are great speakers that I respond to, I can definitely answer that. And I can answer your question as well, but I from my perspective. But to share who I really respond to, Jane Goodall is somebody I really respond to. There is a depth to her, even when she was very young, and a kindness and a sharing and an authenticity that comes from her that I find incredibly engaging. And there's other speakers I find engaging that are very different. Bianca Jagger is somebody I find really engaging. Now, she has a much more somber quality to her. She's a more serious speaker on a lot of levels. She has kind of that Bobby Kennedy gravitas, somber quality to her. But I find her just as engaging, although vastly different. As far as
I'm going to have to stop you there because we're running out of time.
Sorry, I'm just babbling.
That's okay. That's okay. Now that's up to me to do that, to guide you. Okay, so we're talking about your book, Grace Under Pressure, a masterclass in public speaking. And Lisa, your book is available where? Where can we find this?
You can find it at the publisher's website, Lid Publishing. You can also find it on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. Certainly find it on my website, lisawentz.com. And, yeah, those are some good places.
Okay, good. LisaWentz.com. Okay, so that was the next question I was going to ask you is, do you have a website? So you just offered that.
Yeah.
Is your coaching something that has to be done in person, or can you do it remotely? I always ask that because I know most of what I do is remote.
Oh, that's so interesting. So I'm the opposite. Most of what I do is in person. And
okay.
I think likely because I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area and there's so many people here that want the type of coaching that I'm offering. So the in-person is just easy for me. I have a downtown office in San Francisco. That doesn't mean that I would not do some, you know, Skype training or something like that. But typically it's in-person.
It's in-person. Okay, great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, perfect. Is there anything you wanted to say quickly in about a minute? We have about a minute to say it.
If you're listening and you are somebody who thinks, no, I really can't do this, I just want to say, yes, you can. You absolutely can. There is nothing, anybody can be a really great speaker. You're not going to necessarily be everyone's favorite speaker, just like I said, it's subjective. But if you have a message or some thoughts that you want to get out, you have every right to do that, and you have the right to enjoy it, and you have the right to be the best at it that you can be.
That's a great way to end it. I like that. It's empowering. It's positive.
Thank
and
you.
It's empowering. I like that. Well, it was fun. Thanks for being on my show. I appreciate it. And thanks for all the tips and all the little trivia things you've told us. It's fascinating. People don't normally think about, you know, this type of topic. You know, it's just different. So that's why I wanted to have you on, because I like that. Anyway, thank you so much for being my guest. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it as well.
You are welcome. Enjoy your day.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks. So we are out of time for today. If you have any comments or questions, you can email me at loveyourlife@randifine.com, RANDIFINE.com. And please visit my website, randifine.com. There are, over 300 articles there that you can read, enjoy, and share. So thanks. I hope you will visit. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.